to Trojan War, the podcast, history's most awesome epic. This is episode number 3 in the series. Today's episode is titled, The Birth of Achilles. So welcome to episode number 3 of Trojan War, the podcast. This episode is titled, The Birth of Achilles. Now, a lot of you've been into the podcast for 2 episodes already, and so you know how this process operates, and you know that I'm telling an ongoing epic story in serialized form, and we're on to episode number 3. But there's a possibility that some of you listening right now have stumbled across this podcast completely by accident, and this is your first exposure to Trojan War, the epic. And if that's the case, well, you're more than welcome to hang around. In this particular episode, I'm going to be recounting a lot of the really incredibly interesting and fun stories about the birth and the early childhood years of the great hero Achilles. And these stories and this particular episode will serve very nicely as a freestanding, independent episode. You'll have an awful lot of fun. On the other hand, I'd venture that you'll have even more awful lot of fun if you, instead of listening to this episode right away, make a quick trip over to my website and tune into podcast episodes number 1, followed by podcast episode number 2 before you get on to this one. Either choice is yours, and I'll let you make that right now. So, if you recall back to the end of episode number 1, the episode titled The Apple of Discord, the wedding of Peleus and Thetis had been horribly disrupted by the goddess of Discord. Now, Peleus, you'll recall, was a Bronze Age Greek warlord, sort of a medieval kind of king in the Bronze Age, and Thetis, his bride, his very reluctant bride, who had been forced to marry him against her wishes, well, Thetis was an immortal sea nymph. Well, the two of them had left the wedding hall in Mount Olympus and made their way back to Peleus' estate and done their best to settle into some sort of a domestic routine, Peleus desperately hoping that someday Thetis would warm to him, and Thetis, who was quite convinced that she had married a man about 900 stations below her own dignity. My God, he was a mortal of all things. Well, the two of them were trying to make their marriage work, but it wasn't very happy. But something good must have happened, because our story opens 9 months after Peleus and Thetis returned to Peleus' estate. And in every story, of course, if you've moved forward 9 months, well, it means that a baby is on the way. And indeed, a baby is on the way. As our story opens, Thetis is in the ladies' quarters of the palace, in the birthing room, actually sitting on the birthing chair and accompanied by a midwife, deep into the throes of labor. Peleus, meanwhile, being a Bronze Age man, is staying as far away from the mystery of birth as possible. He's in the far end of the palace. Like men in all cultures everywhere up to the present, us guys seem to really be into the conception end of the proceedings and much less enthusiastic about the 9 months later delivery end. So, our story opens with Thetis laboring and Peleus pacing. Peleus, of course, though he doesn't want to watch the mysteries of birth, is deeply invested in this child that his wife is giving birth to. And Peleus is desperately, desperately, desperately hoping 2 things. He's hoping, first of all, that the child is healthy. And number 2, he's desperately hoping that the child that his wife is about to give birth to is a boy, a son. And there are reasons for this, of course. Peleus is a Bronze Age warlord, and he knows that his primary duty is to produce a son, an heir, and ideally a backup emergency son or two in case something happens to the first one, so that if Peleus dies early, in battle or in disease or illness or misadventure or something like that, there is a very clear and designated line of succession to inherit Peleus's kingdom. Because if there isn't a male son, if there isn't an heir, then of course the possibility is that if Peleus dies, his kingdom will collapse into strife and possibly civil war as different factions and relatives and families argue for who should take over Peleus's estate. So Peleus has a duty to produce a son and then get very quickly on to producing a second and a third son, ideally, as quickly as possible. Well, as I said, Thetis labors, Peleus paces. And then the midwife came rushing into the men's quarters of the palace with the good news. Thetis had given birth to, gods be praised, a healthy child, and gods be doubly praised, a boy. Well, Peleus was overjoyed, thrilled with this news, and he rushed to the ladies' quarters of the palace, where by this stage he was fully expecting that the midwife would have cleaned up the baby, cut the umbilical cord, and the baby would be ready for the presentation of dad. Now, this was a critical thing inside of the Bronze Age world that really, really, really is important. The idea that all children, once they were born, were equally welcome was a foreign concept inside of the Bronze Age culture of this story. There was a very clear and distinct possibility that the father of a child would inspect the child and decide that for some reason or other, either a perceived physical or a mental defect, or in many cases, a perceived gender defect, the father would order the child to be exposed or killed or something like that. And I guess I can say with bitter irony, isn't it good we don't live in a world where that kind of thing happens today? Well, anyway, when Peleus arrived to inspect his child, the midwife had already ensured him that the child was physically healthy, looked to be alert, bright, and happy, and was a boy for sure, so Peleus wasn't at all worried. He made it to the birthing room, and that's when things went bad. When he arrived at the birthing room, he discovered his wife Thetis cradling in her arms a dead baby boy. A baby boy that not 5 minutes earlier, when the midwife had left the birthing room looking for Peleus, had been declared healthy and happy and alive and kicking in all respects. And now here was Peleus's first son, dead. There wasn't a scratch in the boy's body. Well, it hit Peleus like a punch to the gut, and I know there are people listening that will go, well, you know, we know about infant and maternal mortality rates in the Bronze Age world, and they're shockingly high, and an awful lot of babies, of course, didn't actually survive birth itself or the first few days afterwards. So you could be a cruel clinical statistician here and say, well, the odds weren't that great that the baby would survive anyway, so why is Peleus so upset? But I still have to imagine that it was his son, and now his son is dead, and I'm sure nothing prepared Peleus for that. Well, Peleus sucked in his gut and thought, well, I should likely comfort Thetis. But Thetis, the sea nymph, who was still holding the dead corpse in her arms, appeared distinctly unmoved by the loss of her child. Thetis appeared detached, cold, distant even, and Peleus was confused by this briefly, and then he thought, well, she is an immortal sea nymph. She is a deity. Maybe she expresses her emotions differently than a human woman might. So Peleus put it out of his mind. Well, the next couple of weeks in the Peleus family palace were pretty rough as Peleus adjusted to the shock of having lost his son, but eventually Peleus sucked in his gut and he reasoned, well, I'm young, I'm fit, I'm healthy, and Thetis, an immortal sea nymph, well, she will always be young and fit and healthy. We will just try again. And so within a few months, Peleus was back on the horse, so to speak, and Thetis was pregnant with her second child. Well, folks, I'll save you the melodrama, the pathos, and the tragedy and the possible suspense by very quickly recounting what happened next. A normal birth, a healthy baby declared by the midwife, and by the time Peleus had made it to the birthing room to inspect the boy, another dead baby in his wife Thetis's arms. And Over the years to follow, it happened 6 times in a row. 6 pregnancies, 6 healthy baby boys, and then within 5 minutes of the birth of those healthy baby boys, 6 dead children cradled in Thetis's arms. Well, by the end of the 6th dead child, Peleus was a physical and emotional wreck. It was taking a terrible, terrible toll on him. The only reason he continued to attempt to have more children is because he knew he had this duty to produce a son to inherit his estates. The strangest thing, though, is that Thetis, with the death of every one of her children, seemed singularly unmoved and unconcerned by the entire process and the loss. And after death number 6, Peleus began to wonder and suspect things that those of us listening have likely already been wondering and suspecting sometime earlier. So during pregnancy number 7, Peleus decided to act on his suspicions. He secretly drilled a tiny spy hole into the wall of the birthing room in the ladies' quarters. And when Thetis went into labor, Peleus discreetly moved into an adjoining room and watched through that spy hole the mysteries of birth as they unfolded. And what Peleus saw confirmed his worst fears, suspicions, and nightmares. His wife Thetis had a normal labor, an easy one actually. And then a baby was born. The midwife cut the umbilical cord, washed the child, held him up for inspection, and then turned around to Thetis and said, "Gods be praised and God's willing, my lady, this one is a boy and this one maybe will live." Then the midwife had placed the baby in Thetis' arms and said, I will go get Peleus. I will tell him the good news." And as Peleus watched from his spy hole, he watched what Thetis did the minute the midwife left the room. She took her child, her healthy boy, son number 7, grasped him firmly by the feet, turned him upside down, and plunged him headfirst into a bucket of salt water that was sitting beside the birthing chair, and held him there. And Peleus suddenly realized what had happened to his first 6 sons. Thetis, his reluctant bride, the sea nymph, was drowning all of them. Well, Peleus, on instinct, immediately left his spy room, charged into the birthing room, grabbed the little baby boy, pulled him out of the salt water, slapped him on the back, and gods be praised, the kid coughed and spluttered for a few moments, but was then very obviously alive. Well, Peleus drew his sword and then turned to confront his wife and asked her the obvious question, "Why have you been drowning our children?" And Thetis, the reluctant sea nymph, showed no remorse, no guilt, no sense of apology, nothing. She coldly and clinically looked at Peleus and she explained to him that she hadn't wanted to marry Peleus, that this had been forced on her by Zeus, and that she didn't like sleeping with Peleus. In fact, she loathed sleeping with Peleus, but again, that had been forced on her by Zeus. But there was no way under Zeus's creation that she was going to give birth and raise half-breed human children. Ladies and gentlemen, the only way to explain this is that, well, Thetis was history's first Slytherin, and there was absolutely no way that she was going to possibly grace her husband with a half-blood prince. Now, it's interesting, inside of a lot of the epics, well, we might not understand Thetis' reluctance, but inside of the epics, it's pretty clear. In the epic tradition, in the Bronze Age world, and not just inside of Greek mythology, but all over the place, well, in a lot of the stories, there's a curious and strange sort of double standard going on. If a coupling happens between a male god and a female human, then the child that's produced, that moment of immaculate conception, is celebrated as a wonderful, awesome gift. And the child is considered something truly, truly special. But in the very rare, rare cases in Greek mythology, and when the reverse happens and a human male impregnates a goddess. Well, the goddess isn't too thrilled about it, and the child is generally neglected, despised, and rejected by the female goddess. It's a double standard, so just in fairness to Thetis, she's not the only goddess that has been revolted at the idea of being forced to give birth to a human being on a male husband. Well, whatever the case, Peleus, he looked at Thetis. He didn't know how to respond. He was beside himself. What do you do with this? What do you do with this situation? But there was an immediate problem, of course. The baby required feeding, and this was the Bronze Age, so Peleus didn't have the option of immediately putting him onto some form of baby formula. The baby needed to be breastfed, and the baby was hungry, and Peleus pointed at Thetis, and he struck a bargain with her. He said, "Listen, I want you out of this palace and out of this child's life as quickly as possible. But the boy has got to live. So you feed him and you stay here, and I will watch and make sure that nothing goes wrong when you feed him until I have an opportunity to send out messengers. We will bring a wet nurse in. And the moment I found somebody to raise this child and feed him, I will raise him on my own, and you, Thetis, can return to the Mediterranean. I never want to see you again. You will have nothing to do with my boy. But right now, I need you to feed him." And Peleus had forced the tiny baby boy onto the reluctant sea nymph's breast. And he began to suckle. And in that moment, well, the weirdest thing happens, and I can only account what the myths tell us, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not responsible for the stories, but the myths are pretty clear that the strangest thing happened. The moment that Thetis allowed that baby boy to breastfeed, well, the reluctant sea nymph suddenly was overwhelmed by maternal love and urges which she had never experienced in her life, and which, well, completely threw her. Thetis underwent an instant, well, forgive me, sea change. And after killing her first six children with salt water, it was very clear that Thetis was in love and was going to set out to smother the seventh one in love and maternal kindness. It's hard to explain. I mean, modern day psychology would say, well, this is just an illustration of the powerful bond that is created between mother and child through the act of breastfeeding. And you know, if that's the case, then Thetis would certainly be the ultimate poster girl for the Lelesch League people. But it's still hard to believe. In fact, so hard to believe that For the few weeks after it happened, Peleus kept the closest of eyes on Thetis. He never let the little baby out of his sight. And it took him about a month before he actually genuinely believed that this miracle had happened and Thetis was actually desperately in love with her little baby boy and was not going to harm him, but instead was going to use everything inside of her power as a demigod to try to protect her child from harm. And so the little baby boy, son number seven, the son that lived, and isn't it curious how seventh sons show up in so many mythologies, although actually, if you think about it, you're more likely to find them inside of American blues music than you are inside of Bronze Age Greece culture, but there you go. Well, seventh son, son number seven, grew up and lived happily under the maternal love of Thetis, the sea nymph, and under the paternal care and protection of Peleus, the proud father who finally had an heir for his throne. Well, the day came when the little baby turned 1 year old. Now, inside of Bronze Age culture, what with the horrifying infant mortality rates and things like that, a lot of the time you didn't really even bother to name your child until the child had made it to the end of his first year of life, because the odds were that so many of those babies were going to die in the first year anyway, so don't get yourself too attached to the kid till he gets to one. But by the time children got to 1 year old, well, an awful lot of the worst of the hazards of the early years were over, and it was time to have a birthday and a name day celebration for the child. Now it was time to invite the friends and the family and the relatives in and to give the child a name. So Peleus asked Thetis, "Do you have any ideas? Do you know what you want to call the kid?" And Thetis said, "I've been thinking about it for a little while." Now, of course, Thetis didn't have the advantage of all the baby name books or website searches that we would today. She was kind of left on her own in a pre-literate culture to come up with a name, but she came up with a short list, and she brought the short list to her husband Peleus and said, "I've got a few ideas. Let me run them by you." And Peleus said, "It's a kid. He's healthy. He's a boy. I don't really care, but what are you thinking of?" And she said, "Well, the first one I thought might be nice is I was thinking of calling him Arthur." Peleus looked a little confused at that. He said, "It doesn't sound very Greek," so she went down the list. Frodo. No, not so much, Pele said. She said, I don't know, Harry, what do you think of Harry? And again, Pele said, I'm not quite sure that's right. And in quick succession, she went through a couple others and finally said, Percy, maybe Luke. Pele didn't like any of them. Thetis came back a day later and she said, well, this one's a little bit off the beaten path, but what if we called her son Achilles? Pele sighed. He said, well, it doesn't sound like a very heroic name. No one will remember it, but whatever. He's healthy. The boy's name will be Achilles. And so, ladies and gentlemen, the little baby boy, the seventh son, the son who lived, ended up being named Achilles. Well, they held a huge party and celebrated the birthday of Achilles, the name day of Achilles, and all of Pele's relatives, the human relatives, trundled to the Pele's estate, and they brought gifts, and even some of the folks from Thetis' side of the family came, and even a couple of the Olympian goddesses graced the occasion with their presence, and everybody was having a fine old time. It was a wonderful party until sometime in the wee hours of the morning when, well, it sort of went off the rails a little bit. And here's what happened. A couple of the minor goddesses visiting from Mount Olympus had, well, maybe got a little bit too deep into the nectar and began to chat in a corner in what they thought were soft voices, but which were actually loud, drunken voices. And they were overheard by Thetis. And Thetis immediately, who was very, very concerned about anything to do with Achilles, said, I heard you talking. I heard my son's name. What are you talking about? And the goddesses, realizing they'd been overheard, said, well, nothing, nothing, nothing. We were just saying we're really happy about Achilles. And they just said, I heard you say the word prophecy. And she eventually wrestled out of the two goddesses what they'd been gossiping about. And the gist of it was that the two goddesses up in Olympus had heard a series of prophecies concerning this child, Achilles. And well, apparently up on Mount Olympus, the gossip circles were alive and talking about this thing, but they were trying to keep it from Thetis, and now it was too late. So Thetis said, what have you learned? And the goddesses, well, spilled the beans. And here's what the prophecies were saying about the little baby Achilles. The prophecy said that Achilles, unlike any other human being who had ever walked the face of the earth, was going to have not one fate or destiny, but instead two possible fates or destinies, two possible routes or paths or roads that Achilles was going to follow through his life. Well, Thetis pressed. She said, well, what are the two paths? What are the two roads? And the goddesses said, well, the one possible option for your son is that he will grow up to be the greatest, most celebrated warrior in the entire history of the Bronze Age and of every age for that matter. And he will have amazing exploits. He will do heroic deeds. Everybody will know his name. He'll live a glorious, heroic, wonderful, exciting, glamorous life. And then he will die violently in his youth. Thetis said, oh, and what's option number two? Well, in option number two, Achilles was going to lead a long, quiet, simple, restrained life, surrounded by nothing but a small circle of immediate family and friends, and then, in his very, very late years, die peacefully and quietly in his bed, to be forgotten by history forever. Well, Thetis made further inquiries of the goddesses. She said, well, this thing about two possible fates. I mean, you don't normally get to choose your fate, but if there's two routes, is my son Achilles going to get to choose? Is he going to get to decide which of these two options? Or are they? Is one of them just going to eventually happen to him? And the goddesses genuinely didn't know. Nobody knew. So whether Achilles was going to get to choose between plan A, heroic short life, and plan B, long, boring, tedious life, or whether one of the two was just going to happen to him inevitably sometime in the future, well, that was a question that nobody on Olympus even knew the answer to. Well, Thetis, of course, immediately and quite reasonably began to worry about the long-term well-being of her son, because Thetis knew that, well, she lived in a Bronze Age culture that celebrated war. Achilles' dad was a celebrated warlord, and she knew that her son Achilles would someday become a teenager, and if confronted with the choice between fate one, heroic celebrity and early death, or fate two, a long, boring, tedious life, well, she knew that as a teenager, Achilles would choose plan A. And Thetis thought, I don't want my boy to die. I want to keep him alive through his youth. I want him to have a long and happy life, even if it's got to be a mortal life. So Thetis, the sea nymph, the overprotective mother, had sat up all night after everybody else had left Achilles' name day party, researching how she could possibly avert the fates and ensure that her son ended up living a long, quiet, peaceful, happy life and didn't in any way end up dying violently in his youth. She consulted everybody. She even made a quick trip up to Mount Olympus and talked to a couple of the deities. And by morning, she had found a possible solution. She had learned of an obscure prophecy concerning Achilles, yet another prophecy. This boy, like all the heroes and all the great epics, well, the prophecies, the stories about his coming, about what would happen, about the portents, about the signs and everything like that, they were there well in advance of the birth of Achilles himself. And now Thetis found this prophecy, and in the morning when Peleus woke up beside his wife, he realized that she was already bundling up Achilles, and he said, "What are you doing?" And Thetis said, "We're going on a road trip. Come on, we have to leave right away." Peleus said, "Where are we going?" And Thetis said, "We're going to protect our son Achilles from a possible violent death in his youth." And with no further explanation, they hopped onto horses in a chariot and off they went. Thetis very clear in where they were going, and Peleus just following along behind, desperately holding on tight to the little bundle of one-year-old Achilles. Well, where Thetis directed them was to the river Styx. Now, Thetis, as an immortal sea nymph, would have been very familiar with this river. The river Styx was a river that surrounded the land of the living from the land from the dead. And when people died and they made the passage from the land of the living to Hades, the land of the dead, they had to cross the river Styx with the help of a ferryman, usually. And while the river Styx was always purported to have these special and magical qualities, but the interesting thing about the prophecy that Thetis had heard about the river Styx is that the prophecy had stated that if Achilles were to be dunked into the river Styx, then the river Styx's magical properties would somehow act as a protective coating over the flesh of the child Achilles and render him immune from any form of scratch, cut, or injury as long as he was alive. In short, this river was going to have incredibly protective qualities for Achilles. And Thetis reasoned, well, the kid can't be cut, scratched, or harmed. Then as he grows up and he chooses a path of heroic warriordom and goes off into wild and crazy battles and adventures, well, I won't have to worry about him being killed in those battles or adventures. So Mom had reasoned, well, I'm going to take the kid to the river and dip him in the river, and maybe the prophecy will be right and maybe it will help. Well, they traveled all day by chariot, and late that afternoon, they made it to the shores of the river Styx. They got off the chariot, and Peleus, holding on to his one-year-old son Achilles, brought him down to the shores of the river, and Thetis followed along and looked at the river. And when Peleus saw the river, of course, his heart sunk, because the river Styx was in full spring flood. The current was icy cold. The water was fast. Peleus dipped his finger into the river and realized, I don't think I could hold my finger in that river for more than a minute before it would freeze. How are we possibly going to dunk my child into the river to protect him from harm? And he'd said, let's not do this, Thetis. But Thetis said, the prophecy said, this is the only way to protect our son from harm. We will do it. So Thetis had taken her son, who she loved, and taken off his clothes and gone down to the very edge of the river, right near a very fast section of current, stripped Achilles naked, and then held him upside down by the feet and prepared to dunk him into the river. And it was only then that the whole shattering, dramatic irony of the situation hit Thetis as she realized that the prophecy was requiring her to do to her seventh son, the one she wanted to live, precisely what she had done to kill the six previous boys. Dunk them head first into cold water. Well, she was shaken for a moment. Was this some form of fate or some form of deific revenge? Was she going to drown this child? But she had done her research. She thought her sources were good on this prophecy. So turning around with the little baby Achilles hanging upside down in the air, held by the foot, Thetis said, "Mummy loves you. This is for your own good." And plunged her kid headfirst into the icy waters of the river Styx. She held him there for 5 full seconds, counting down from 5, 5, 4, 3, 2. Poor Peleus nearly passed out in fear as he watched this happen, just convinced that son Never Seven was about to drown too. But Thetis made it down to the count of 0, pulled young Achilles out of the water, and gods be praised, Achilles, though he was blue, coughing and screaming and choking, was very much alive. So They dried him off, they bundled him up, they brought him back to the Peleus family estate, and then it was just a matter of watching and waiting to see if the River Styx did its magic thing. Would Achilles be immune from all form of physical injury? Well, they didn't have to wait for long. About 6 months after the incident at the River Styx, Thetis had left Achilles in the care of Peleus, and Peleus had decided to bring the boy out into the fields. Peleus was supervising some work on his farms, and Peleus was watching Achilles. Achilles was already an incredibly trundly little athlete of a 1.5-year-old. He was crawling around quite nicely and comfortably on his own, and so he was following along Dad as Dad was reviewing the work in the fields. And as Peleus was briefly distracted, a poison snake slithered into the fields. The poison snake slithered up to a 2-ton ox, bit the ox in the heel, and the oxen immediately rolled over and died. Well, the servants, seeing this, recognized that there was a poisoned serpent in the field. One of the servants grabbed a sword and charged quite heroically, and it turned out pointlessly at the serpent, swung, missed, and then the servant got bit by the serpent himself. And the servant rolled over and died instantly. And then, to Peleus's horror, because he was some way down the fields and couldn't get there in time, the serpent slithered up to the 1.5-year-old baby boy Achilles. And the serpent bit Achilles. And the serpent died instantly. The kid, it turned out, could not be harmed or injured. And as the months went by and as the years went by, it was very obvious to Peleus and Thetis that the River Styx had done his job. There was nothing you could do. This kid, it didn't matter what you did to him. He came out of it without a scratch or a bruise on his body. And as a consequence, as Achilles grew up, as he got 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, Achilles began to gradually transform into, well, the most incredible warrior and soldier that the Bronze Age world had ever seen, because Achilles was just one incredibly kick-ass gifted athlete. Now, if you think about it, there was a reason why. I grew up playing some sports, and I had lots of coaches when I grew up playing sports. You know, say those cliches like, when you go out there onto the field, boys, make sure that you give 100%. Well, I never gave 100% because I realized very quickly that I could give 80%. But if I gave somewhere between 80 and 100%, well, 90% was likely going to lead to me getting badly injured, and 100% was likely going to be death. So I always held off. I never really wanted to give it all because I wanted to live. I didn't want to get hurt. But can you imagine the situation of a young athlete today if the young athlete knew that no matter how hard they tried, no matter what percentage they gave, no matter how crazy a move they tried to make with their sword, or no matter how crazy a move they tried to make leaping from one chariot to another, that even if the move failed, they weren't going to be hurt, injured, scratched, or bruised. Well, then you could give 100%. And that's what Achilles turned out to be. So by the time he was 13 years old, he had turned into history's most gifted athlete. And of course, athletics in the ancient Bronze Age world were just preparation for war. I mean, Achilles practiced running, he practiced racing chariots, he practiced throwing javelins, he practiced mock sword fighting, that sort of thing. And by the time he was 13, he was besting men twice his age with twice the experience. But it wasn't just in the athletic department that Achilles was gifted and blessed. His mom, you know, was a demigod. So Achilles, though he was fully human, had incredible DNA running through his system. And as a consequence, Achilles was not only a gifted athlete, he was also blessed with a stunningly hot body. I mean, this guy was naturally ripped and cut. Achilles didn't spend a day in the gym, but he had incredible pecs. He had a six-pack of abs by the time he was 12 years old, long, lean muscles. And it wasn't just his body that was amazing. He had devastatingly good looks. This guy had long, golden, flowing locks. He seemed to be born with just the perfect sun-kissed tan. And his face, well, he had these sensitive, pouty lips and deep blue eyes that when you looked into them would melt your heart. Ladies and gentlemen, in short, Achilles was not only history's most dangerous killing machine. Achilles grew up to be history's most gorgeous killing machine. And that wasn't all. Thetis, the mum, just couldn't help but dote on her only child, and of course Peleus had deep pockets, so nothing was good enough for Achilles as he turned into his teenage years. And when Achilles became a teenager, mum decided it was time to send him off to private boarding school, which is what all the best families did with their sons. But, you know, they didn't just send him to a standard boarding school like Hogwarts or something like that. Oh no, only the best for Achilles. Achilles was actually privately tutored by, well, by a centaur. Achilles had a centaur for a mentor. The centaur's name was Chiron, and he was a famous centaur. He'd been around for centuries, half man, half horse, and his resume was really spectacular. He had tutored all of the best heroes, and of course that meant that he was going to tutor Achilles. So Achilles had headed off into deep into the tutelage place where Chiron did his work, high up in a mountain, and for a few years, Achilles was taught only the art of being a great warrior, but Chiron offered the full benefits package. So Achilles, by the time he was 18 years old, was not only a great athlete, he was a great healer. He could play the lyre with sensitivity and grace and sing a beautiful song if need be. And he had a complete understanding of literature and arts and culture. And he could recite all the great Bronze Age epics by heart. And he had learned social skills and manners well beyond his years. In short, by the time Achilles was 18 years old, he was the complete package. Athletically gifted, stunningly hot, and likely the most educated and cultured 18-year-old boy in the entire Mediterranean world. But it came with a price. Because Achilles, along with all these other gifts, somehow along the way picked up a sense of his own self-worth or entitlement. Achilles, an only child of overprotective parents, blessed with all these things, inevitably ended up with an incredibly, incredibly powerful sense of his own value. Achilles, by the time he was 17 years old, had begun socially speaking about himself in the third person. He'd say things like, "Today the Achilles will go swimming. Who would care to swim with the Achilles? Today the Achilles will practice the javelin. Who cares to watch Achilles throw the javelin?" He ended up with an insufferable sense of his own value and an ego which was almost inevitable given the way that he was raised. But he wasn't particularly happy. Because as he lay awake at night in his 18th year of his life, he was stuck with nothing to do. He was bored. He could go off on yet another hunting trip. He could demonstrate his athletic exploits to yet another of his increasingly large posse of followers and admirers. But it wasn't a life for a hero. Achilles knew he was a hero. Achilles knew he had a destiny. Everything was in place for it. But, well, living in his dad's estate or off being tutored by Chiron the centaur in a mountain was, well, it was not hardly the showcase for Achilles the hero. What he knew he needed was some epic adventure, some chance to showcase to the world that he, Achilles, had arrived on the scene. But that showcase, that opportunity for Achilles to do that, is going to have to wait, folks, for about another 2 podcasts. Because we need to put a couple of tiny little pieces in place first before Achilles can launch off on his great epic adventure. We need to go back and decide who gets the apple of discord. And we've been waiting for a few episodes, but in episode number 4, I promise you, an episode titled The Judgment of Paris, we will finally decide who gets that apple, and the decision that's made in that episode will generate a series of ripple effects which will start in a mountain high above the city of Troy, but in very short order make it to mainland Greece. And that apple, a young prince named Paris with a terrible prophecy over his head and a gifted hero in the waiting named Achilles, will all come clashing together in glorious epic technicolor, and we will end up with our Trojan War. So that's a great place to leave our story for today, and well, you can say goodbye now. And if you're really having fun with the story, head over to my website where podcast number 4, titled The Judgment of Paris, will soon be waiting for you. On the other hand, if you're the kind of person that likes doing backstory kind of things and talking about some of the issues or the concepts behind the story and digging a little bit deeper into them, then hang around. I'm going to be talking about some of the discounted Achilles stories, which I didn't include in my particular episode. And then I'm going to get into a conversation on Achilles as an archetypical hero. And we're going to look at some of the other archetypical heroes that look very much in many respects like Achilles. So you have a couple of options at this point, and for those of you sticking around, let's get into it. One of the challenges that I faced in putting together this episode, as opposed to the previous two episodes, is that in the previous two episodes of the series, I had a very limited number of sources or stories to work with, which meant it was very easy for me to essentially decide what story to tell you. But when I got to this episode, where I was going to be telling you about the birth and the early life of Achilles, well, suddenly I was confronted with a problem of, well, epically, I suppose, not literally, hundreds of options in available sort of directions in which it could go. The ancient world is just littered with Achilles stories. And if you think about it, it's really not a surprise. We all know Achilles' name, and I'm not giving anything away to anybody now if I say that Achilles is going to be the central character in the entire Trojan War epic I'm telling. He's either the protagonist or the hero or the leading character, and you'll make up your mind what you want to call him later. But Achilles is the most well-known character, and he's certainly by far and away, therefore, the most well-loved character. And I think what ended up happening is that, well, over the 1500 year or so period when this Trojan War epic developed between a combination of oral storytelling tradition and written sources, well, everybody just wanted to hear yet one more story about Achilles. And because he was so popular, there was likely a temptation for oral storytellers and then later written storytellers to either flesh out some Achilles stories or to create some brand new ones of their entirely own making, because they knew that there was going to be an audience for this kind of thing. So the challenge that I'm facing is that there's lots and lots of material to choose from, and I can't possibly give you all the Achilles stories because they contradict each other and they don't cobble together very well. So I selected a particular version of the plot line, which I thought made the most sense, but I left a lot of other versions on the cutting floor, and I thought we might have a little bit of fun right now by just quickly reviewing some of the Achilles story options which I chose to reject. So the first one I chose to reject, option number one, and this one's really interesting, is this one concerns the death of those six babies before Thetis finally decides to fall in love with her son Achilles and raise him. And you know that in the version I told you, Thetis is drowning her children because she considers them half-bloods. She loathes these half-human, half-god spawn that she's created, so she drowns them. But in a version I rejected, it turns out that Thetis wasn't actually attempting to drown her children. Thetis is a sea nymph, and what she was doing in this other version of the story is she was attempting to teach her sons how to swim. Yes, she was dunking them head first into seawater because, as a sea nymph, of course, well, she could breathe water. She didn't have gills, but she seemed to be able to pull it off all the same. And I guess she just naturally assumed that the first thing a loving parent has to do is teach their kid how to swim so they'd be comfortable on land and water. And poor Thetis, in this version of the story, is inadvertently drowning her children. In another version of the text, which I chose to reject, Achilles is the only child born. There are no other children in advance or before him. And in that version, the day after he's born, Peleus walks into a room in the palace and sees Thetis holding the young Achilles over top of a fireplace and burning Achilles' flesh. Well, Peleus stops this and then turns around and says, "What are you thinking? Why are you doing this?" And Thetis had gone on to explain that she wanted her son to be a god. And therefore, what she was doing is she was burning away the mortal sections. And she cited precedent to the great Greek hero Heracles that you likely know as Hercules from way, way, way before this story was told. Heracles had been fully human, but on his deathbed, on his funeral pyre, what happened is that as his flesh burned, the mortal part died and the immortal part rose to the heavens. And turned out Thetis was just trying to replicate the process at an earlier stage in her child's life. So there's lots of different accounts out there what could have happened. Curiously, I looked at how Homer, author of the Iliad, approaches Achilles, and it's really, really interesting. And in Homer's Iliad, there's no reference whatsoever to the river Styx and the magical immunity of Achilles. In fact, Homer's Achilles is very clearly capable of being injured. There's a scene in the Iliad where Achilles cannot return to battle because he's lost his armor and he has to wait until a new set of armor is manufactured, because only a madman would go out and fight without armor. And well, clearly, if he was immune from all form of cuts, scrapes, injuries, or bruises, then armor is kind of redundant on a hero like Achilles. Now, what is interesting about all of these Achilles stories is that they all tend to follow a recurring literary archetype, the hero archetype. And if you want to have fun with this stuff, if you're interested in the kind of thing I'm going to talk about in the next second, then the book that you want to read someday is by a guy named Joseph Campbell. It's called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. It was written back, I think, I'm guessing 1949 or so. And what Joseph Campbell does is he looks at all the hero myths across cultures, including Greek Bronze Age culture, but cultures across the planet, and looks at the incredible, remarkable similarities and the way that heroes' lives unfold in all of the different epic stories and myths. So I'm just going to have some fun and focus on a couple of areas, and let's talk about magic tutelage. Achilles, of course, is tutored very famously by a centaur, a half-human, half-horse creature that was gifted for tutoring all of the great ancient Greek mythological heroes. And in his formative years, before Achilles is going to set off on his huge adventures, it was this non-human centaur, the mentor centaur, sorry, it's hard to say together, that really got Achilles going. And the non-human mentor turns out to be a recurring literary archetype. It shows up all over the place. If you think about it, Luke Skywalker, well, it's a Jedi Knight, Obi-Wan Kenobi, that does the work there. Let's go into other mythologies. Let's go to Frodo. Well, Frodo Baggins, of course, is tutored and guided and nursed along before he heads off and his epic adventure and quest by none less than a wizard, Gandalf. Let's move forward a little bit closer to the present and take a look at Harry Potter. Well, Harry, a human being, spends his formative years under the careful guidance and watchful presence of a wizard, Dumbledore, and of course you've got Arthur with another wizard. Then you've even got, if you want to go into animation, you've got Simba, the once and future Lion King, who's going to be mentored and tutored in his formative years before he assumes his heroic destiny under the guidance of a monkey named Rafiki. The next one that's really cool, of course, is that it seems as though all of these heroes have crazy, miraculous childhood adventures before they emerge into manhood and get into doing the serious work for which they are going to be placed onto this earth. So in their formative years, the heroes float around and test out their superpowers and their magical strengths and things like that in some pretty ridiculous ways before they get on to finding the real quest and the real serious adult destiny. And some of the Achilles stories that I rejected simply because they were kind of silly. Well, there's one where Achilles is 5 years old and he's out in the mountains and he's attacked by a lion, a full-grown lion, we're told. And Achilles, finding himself weaponless, manages to wrestle the lion to the ground and kill the lion with his bare hands at 5 years old. Years later, when he's up under the tutelage of Chiron, the centaur for a mentor, Achilles apparently practices hunting deer in the forest. And the way that Achilles hunts the deer is that swift-footed Achilles outruns the deer. Now, I left those two episodes out, but I gave you a taste of it with an episode I actually created on my own, the story of Achilles in the field with a poison snake. But it's very typical, or a typical archetypical episode, if you will, of the kind of ways that the stories talk about this amazing, amazing hero and the cool things he did as a kid. Now, let's look at the others. Arthur, King of the Britons, comes from a humble and unknown background, but somehow manages as a little child to pull a sword out of a stone when every other grown man in the kingdom hasn't been able to do this. Our friend Harry, of course, walks unscathed except for a minor scratch in the forehead out of a building where an evil wizard has just offed his two parents. He's a survivor. His parents die, and of course, Luke Skywalker's parents or step-parents do the very, very same thing in the opening of that particular epic. The point I'm trying to make in all of these stories is that we like the idea of our heroes, before they get onto the big quest, sort of testing out their powers and while they're young. So all of these sort of stories permeate down through the epics. And it presents a problem for storytellers because as a storyteller, you always have to decide on what sort of a character do I want? What sort of an Achilles do I want? Do I want an Achilles character in the stories that I'm telling that are coming up who is fully human? And that's great because then we could empathize and sympathize with the guy and go, oh man, Achilles, he's just a dude like me with problems like me. But we also like the idea of our heroes being special and magical and having being imbued with superpowers and properties that we don't have, because that makes them a lot more fun. And wow, this person is special and unique and wonderful. So in the other hand, we kind of like the idea of an immune superhuman Achilles who cannot be harmed in battle. But it's always a fine balancing act when you're recounting the life of a heroic character and you're talking about myth and you're talking about epic on where to find the line. So I'll be curious to see where you think Achilles should be. And I'll be curious to see how you think I've handled Achilles and the episodes to follow. Have I walked that line between Achilles the human and Achilles the magic guy? And have I found a place where you as a listener are happy and really believe that this character has come alive? And that'll be my task. And you can decide for yourself as you listen to my version of the story and then go listen to other versions of the story and whether I've achieved that happy balance. So that's enough backstory. That's enough little academic conversation for the day. I hope you had fun with the story. I hope you were entertained and possibly informed in the post-story commentary. And it's time to say goodbye. Head off to the website. Episode number 4 of the continuing unfolding stories of the Trojan War epic will be waiting for you. The episode is titled The Judgment of Paris. Have a great day.